The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McKeonis. We have the Book Nook coming up for you. And last year, we had the experience of watching our governor, John Kasich, run for president. And he is still our governor, and he's in his last term, and he just put out a new book. It's been almost 20 years since we had John Kasich on the program. Last time he was here, he was still Congressman Kasich. We're going to bring you my conversation with Governor John Kasich about his new book, coming up right after NPR News in the Book Nook. Good morning. I'm Vic McKeonis. It's a rare experience to interview a sitting governor, and I was able to do that recently. Our Ohio Governor John Kasich has just published a new book. He was out on a media tour for it, and we caught up with him in New York City. Here's my conversation with Governor John Kasich in the Book Nook. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McKeonis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Governor John Kasich. Hello, John.
Vic, how are you?
Excellent. You know, last time we had you on the show, you came by our studio here in Yellow Springs. Your book at the time was called Courage is Contagious, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Things to Change.
Well, that was like 100 years ago.
It was. We talked about music, and you were still Congressman Kasich.
Yeah, I wrote that book in 98, I think, or 99, and then I've had, this is actually my fourth book. The second one was Stand for Something, The Battle for America's Soul. The third one was a faith book called Every Other Monday, and now this book, Two Paths.
It's Two Paths, America Divided or United. It just came out, and the theme to this originated in a speech you gave a year ago in New York City, didn't it?
Well, it did. And, Vic, you know, this book covers things that happened in my campaign, but it's not a campaign memoir. It also is observations about what's happening in our country. And the purpose of Two Paths: do we want to operate as a country that's divided in many different ways, or would we like to figure out a way that we can be united so that we can actually begin to solve some of the problems and also, you know, pull people together? Because that's what it's all about in life, in my view.
And we do get some great insights into the campaign. And I applaud you, Governor, for your unstinting efforts last year to elevate the level of discourse during the presidential primaries. And there's a lot of that in this book.
Well, yes, but I don't want people to just walk away thinking this is just about a campaign. This is about the issues that are troubling all of us, the problems that we see with leaders who sort of forget their values and worship money without values. It is about the importance of faith, and if you don't have faith, if you're a humanist, which your purpose is, it's about the things that have plagued our political system. It's about leadership. It's also about a new term that I don't know if anybody's ever used, but I may have created it, called followship, and what that means to all of us. And the most important thing in this book is that if we want our country to be positive again, if we want our country to be united again, it's not up to somebody else. It's up to all of us wherever we are. And we should be most concerned about what's happening in our neighborhoods, what's happening within our families, and leave all this political stuff, nonsense, at least in the time being, to these politicians, most of whom don't get this.
My guest is Governor John Kasich. His new book is Two Paths, America Divided or United. You just referred to this word you coined, followship, and you state that there's a crisis of followship. What do you mean by that?
Well, let's just take United Airlines and this incredible thing that happened. Well, first of all, I think the leadership has responsibility because they obviously set rules that didn't provide people with discretion. But if you go all the way down to what was happening at the counter that day and the employees who were there, you know, it wasn't appropriate to go treat a guy like, you know, some kind of an object. That's a human being. They have feelings and families and challenges and hurts, and just like all of us do. And it was a failure in the people to some degree who were there, who just didn't say, no, we're not yanking this guy off. We're not going to treat him as some kind of a rag doll. And so here's what I mean by this whole situation of organizations, because I've been able to see it in government, in business, in the media. You know, leaders have to paint a picture, have a vision of how things can be better, that they can take you to a better place. And if they can do that, then people will buy in and they will be the followers. But within the follower community are people who become leaders. The managers are the people who are willing to speak out and speak up when they see something that's not appropriate. And also disruptors, people inside of any organization whose intent is to improve the organization, who are willing to disrupt the flow of things. And then the leader has to consistently continue to paint this vision about why life would be better or the goals are positive. And if any of those things break down, I think you have organizations in trouble. And so we have seen not just a crisis in leadership, but to some degree a crisis in followership.
Well, Governor, here in Ohio, we've seen your leadership, and it's about taking responsibility, and it's about what matters are the moments when we go above and beyond, when we go big, as you say. And
a life bigger than ourselves, Vic. Live a life a little bit, you know, if a nation becomes self-absorbed, if the citizenry becomes self-absorbed, then we don't pay attention to the people who are around us. And that pulls us down, does not lift us up.
I see an example in the expansion of Medicaid where you did something that might not have been popular with your party, but you did what was important and you did what you felt needed to be done.
Well, look, I don't want to paint myself as the definer of all virtue. Frankly, everybody I know, including me, we're all hypocrites. We say one thing and do another. But, you know, what's most important is that we shake that off and as much as we possibly can try to live a life a little bigger than ourselves, try to get it right. You know, in terms of Medicaid expansion, it was actually a pretty easy decision for me. You know, if I can help the drug addicted and the mentally ill and the chronically ill and the federal government's willing to have a partnership with me, why wouldn't I do it? And, you know, if the party doesn't like it, that's the party's problem, not my problem. And so, I think it's helped a lot of people in our state, probably has saved some lives. But it's not as just do that and forget about it, because we have responsibility to be, you know, to have a system that works, that's efficient, because we don't want to put our taxpayers in a position where they get hurt or we can't create jobs in our state. So, you know, this is not really about me and, how I raise my game. It's really about everybody. And Vic, it's also about the fact that everybody matters. If you're the CEO, of course, you know, you have you cut a big swath. But if you're just the person that turns the lights off at night, you might feel at times as though you don't matter, and that's just simply not true, because there's somebody watching you. Somebody's watching your example, somebody who depends on you. And so I believe that in our society, you know, everybody really is equal, particularly when they put us all in the box and particularly when we get judged in terms of life after death, if you happen to have that belief, which I do.
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Governor John Kasich. His new book is Two Paths, America Divided or United. He joins us on the telephone from New York City, where the book is just being rolled out, and you've been doing a ton of media, and we really appreciate you fitting us into your schedule. You were on, what, CBS this morning, and you're going to be on Comedy Central tonight?
I did Face the Nation, and then CBS this morning, and Business Insider, which is a remarkable operation, media operation. and NPR, and I'm going to do the Daily Show and CNN, a town hall. A lot of stuff going on, and I'll be traveling around because I think the message is important. But what's more important than what would be more important than talking to folks in Dayton? I mean, it's my home, right? Ohio's where I'm from, and I appreciate the fact that as an Ohioan, I can go around and talk about my experiences, which the people of Ohio basically gave me, and to see if I can do some good.
John, in the book, you have a story you tell about the time that you and your daughter encountered a moose, and you draw some wisdom from this. Explain.
Well, my daughters and my wife and I were hiking in the middle of nowhere, and we were somewhere in Montana, I think, either there or in Canada, and we were all alone, and we came around a corner, and a big moose stepped right in front of us, probably, 1,000 pounds or more. And the people, when they think about a moose, they think about the moosehead deer, or they think about bullwinkle. Well, the moose is the second most dangerous animal in the woods because of its hooves. That's how it protects itself. And this moose started to snort, which is not a sign of, like, we like you. So I was concerned. And I was walking up front with my daughter, Emma. I grabbed her hand and I whispered, "Emma, just be calm and we'll back up." And slowly we backed up. And then after a few minutes, seemed like an hour, the moose disappeared back down into the woods. So we kept hiking to our destination, and after 10 or 15 minutes, I said to my daughter, Emma, what did you think about that moose? And she was about 8 or 9 or 10 years old, and she looked at me and she said, "What moose, Daddy?"
Mm.
Her little mind could not grasp the enormity of the situation, and sometimes I think that's where we are in this country, where we really want to live in denial of what we see when we face things that are difficult. And my view is, yes, we all face things that are difficult. That's why we need people around us that can help us through the difficult times, and why we need to recognize things as we see them and not head in the sand and think they'll all go away. And so I particularly like that chapter, and Emma still says to me, "What moose, Daddy?" She's now 17.
As you and Emma were tiptoeing away from this moose, could we describe that as a moment of grace?
We could describe that as a moment of prudence. I wasn't going to fight a moose,
uh-huh.
and I wasn't going to run,
uh-huh.
and I was going to handle it, with calm. That's really, I guess, to some degree, the story was more about Emma. But if you're asking me about how I handled it, you just try to be calm. You don't try to spook the moose or show fear. And if you're calm, you're likely to get out of a situation like that. Thank God it wasn't a grizzly bear, a mama with her cubs. Mm. Then you got a whole nother situation.
I love your personal stories in this book. And I know it's not a memoir and it's not a book about politics. It's an inspirational book. But one of my favorite stories is your account of how you met President Richard Nixon.
Well, listen, I tell you why I have these stories in here. When I was really starting to write this book, there's a guy who works with me on this. He brings a tape recorder, and I record my thoughts, and they transcribe them and put them on paper, and then I go and I fix up what's on the paper. And I was saying, why am I telling the stories about who I am? And he said, "John, before you can tell them what you think, you need to tell them who you are."
Mm.
And he's exactly right. And I've told the story before, but I think it's a terrific story. Here it is. I'm at Ohio State. I ask for a meeting with the president of the university. I have trouble getting in. I finally do. I go in. I talk to him about some things that were on my mind, and I asked him about his job and what he did, and he told me the next day he was going to go down and see President Nixon, and I asked him if I could go with him, and he said no, and I said, "But if I write a letter, would you give it to the president?" He said he would. So I wrote a letter. I'm 18 years old, a first quarter freshman. I wrote a letter to President Nixon, kind of with some of my thoughts, and, most of them were positive. And I wrote, "If you'd like to talk about this further, let me know." And the president wrote me back and invited me to the White House. And so I told my mother and father I was going to need an airline ticket to go to Washington to see the president, and they were dumbfounded, but they got me a ticket, and they told me I was going to get 5 minutes with the president. And make a long story short, I walked into the Oval Office, sat down with President Nixon, and spent 20 minutes in the Oval Office with the President of the United States as an 18-year-old freshman. The reason why I think the story is cool is that I wasn't anybody, and my father was I was somebody special. I was the son of a mailman, and you know, so but it was unusual that a mailman's son, first quarter 18-year-old freshman, could have a meeting with the President of the United States. It tells you that in life, anything is possible if only you reach and you try.
Well, it's a great story, and you have a lovely photo of you shaking hands with the President. The book is Two Paths, America Divided
or United. You know, it's funny about this, Vic. I've never shared this on the air with anybody. But when I travel, you know, there will be these autograph seekers. I mean, they'll go towards any politician or, you know, sports star or whatever, and they'll take these pictures from the internet hoping that you're going to become something, and then they can sell them, right? And that's all part of their business. And I will almost always sign everything that they put in front of me, but one picture I will not sign is that picture with me and Richard Nixon when I was 18 years old. It's just such a such a special moment, and stands in my head as something that is so unique that I felt that this was my stuff, my deal, and I wanted to kind of keep it with to myself and my family and my dearest friends.
Keeping it special. I loved your alternative title for this book, and I know it's tongue-in-cheek, but you said it could have been called Fear and Goading on the Campaign Trail.
Yeah, the old Hunter Thompson book, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, and you know, I mean, when you think about the campaign and how politicians besmirched one another, and really I think, threw dirt on the whole profession of politics. You know, I know we're cynical about it. I know that we've seen a lot of political leaders that have let us down. I was with a grand old man, Senator Richard Lugar from Indiana. I ran into him in the airport as I was headed to Washington to start the book tour. He's 80 years old, and he was an incredible statesman. He worked with Democrats. He was a Republican from Indiana. He worked with Democrats. He was very, very involved in disarmament and trying to settle down the Soviet Union as it collapsed, to make sure we didn't have loose nukes. And yeah, he's just a terrific guy, and he was the best of what you could look for. You know, Senator Taft from Ohio. Senator Robert Taft Sr., they voted him as one of the five greatest senators. He served from, I think, 1939 to 1953. Those were times when people put country ahead of party. It's when they were willing to take risks for the good of the common good, even if it cost them. And when I see people, you know, pandering or scaring people or making false promises, I don't like it. And frankly, the fact that I was governor of Ohio, the fact that the people let me have the privilege of being governor, was a disadvantage for me. And the reason why it was a disadvantage is I could not get into overpromising. You can't tell people you're going to do something that you know in the back of your mind can't be accomplished. And so this was, it was difficult for me to see this. And I pointed out in the book.
And Bob Taft, was it Bob Taft? No, that was his grandson.
Robert Taft Sr.
Right, Robert Taft Sr. You have some quotes from him, his viewpoints upon health care, and I found those very illuminating.
Well, that was actually an article written by a reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and it's pretty interesting what he had to say. He said that if people in America cannot afford health care, they should be given health care. You know, the one thing you don't want to have people doing is, you know, having a life where there's so much uncertainty about their health. I mean, think about it. There's enough uncertainty in life where if all of a sudden you can't get any health care, you get a bad report from a doctor, you have nowhere to go. I mean, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. So we have to think about that. You know what? One of the things we have to do, Vic, is put ourselves in other people's shoes from time to time. And when we do that, we get a little different point of view, and we stop the fighting, and we stop all the ideological battles we see today, and we start thinking about our common humanity.
My guest is Governor John Kasich. He's written a book called Two Paths, America Divided or United, and he shared a little bit of his busy day with us today. I just have enough time for one more observation, one more comment before we let you go, John. Near the end of the book, you describe when Donald Trump had become the nominee and he was looking for a running mate, and your name apparently was under consideration, and you describe a phone call that you had with him in which he made the statement to you, politicians are like levers, and you responded by saying, well, Donald, I'm not a politician.
Well, here's the thing. He did not call me up to ask me to be his running mate. In the book, it's described as a phone call that one of my top staffer advisors took from somebody on his team. When Donald Trump called me, he asked what he could do to get me to support him. And I said, look, we're like two companies, you know, with different goals and different values and different missions. And I want you to read this Two Paths speech that I gave in New York that said that we should lift people rather than give them reason to feel badly about things or ripped off. And I said, if you read that speech, you know, let me know what you think. And, you know, there are a lot of people who think the reason I didn't endorse Trump or I didn't go to the convention was because I was bitter. Look, I've never been happier than I am in my life. And I have no regrets about my political campaign. It's just what people need to realize is sometimes, even when politicians have principles, sometimes they just want to stick to them. And that's precisely what I did. And that's why I let Donald know that, you know, the things I said, I meant deeply. And, you know, if he was going to become more positive, I'd help him. But if he wasn't, there was no room for me to offer support. Now that he's president, of course, I'm hoping he's going to do well. And I had a meeting with him that lasted for a long time in the Oval Office, went down, gave him my views, and I wish him the best. When he does well, if I'm in a position, I'll praise it. If he does something I think is wrong, well, you might hear my criticism.
And you've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, my conversation with Governor John Kasich, recorded recently for his new book. And he mentioned in the interview how thrilled he was to get 20 minutes in the Oval Office with President Richard Nixon when he was a freshman at Ohio State. And I was delighted to get 20 minutes with our Governor John Kasich in the Book Nook. The Book Nook will continue. Up next, an interview with Lyanda Lynn Haupt for an amazing new book. It's called Mozart's Starling. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Hello, Lyanda.
Hi.
Where are you?
I am in Seattle, Washington, a neighborhood called West Seattle, just across the bridge from downtown.
Okay. Well, you have written an amazing book, and I just love this book. It's called Mozart's Starling. Tell our listeners how you got the idea to do this.
Thank you. Well, I had heard for years and years that Mozart had a pet starling, and I even mentioned it sort of offhandedly in one of my earlier books. But there was a day that I was working on something completely different up in my study here in Seattle, and I looked out on the grassy parking strip, and there were a group of about 20 starlings. And they, you know, I rapped on the window to get them to go away because not everybody knows this, Vic, but they are literally among conservationists and biologists and nature writers. They are the most hated and reviled bird in the country. They're, you know, a non-native invasive species. So when they land on my lawn and they scare the sweeter little chickadees away, I always rap on the window to get them to fly off. But so this day I did that. I rapped on the window and, you know, they're just like teenagers. They don't care. You know, they just kind of looked at me. And so I rapped on the window harder. And this time they leapt up off the ground just a bit and they turned into the sun. And when they did that, I could see the shining iridescence of the feathers on their breasts. I mean, starlings are painted like oil slicks. They're this mixture of shimmering kind of black and magenta and purple and black. And that iridescence just came to life in that moment. And then they settled. They still didn't leave. Of course, they settled back on the grass. And oddly enough, you know, in terms of synchronicity, at the same time, I noticed that on my iPhone Pandora station, the Mozart Prague symphonies were playing. So it brought to mind that remembrance of the story that Mozart had a pet starling, and also just in that moment put into relief the dissonance of that story, because on the one hand, we have this most revered and most sublime of, you know, Western classical composers in many's opinion. And then on the other hand, we have this hated bird and who, you know, Mozart apparently kept as a pet. And when I looked at them that day, I thought, I hate starlings. I'm supposed to hate starlings, but gosh, they're beautiful too. So all of this, you know, dissonance and complexity about what beauty is and where inspiration can strike and how complicated that can be just all started to make me kind of obsessed, really. So I just went down the rabbit hole of this story.
And the result is the book Mozart's Starling, written by Lyanda Lynn Haupt, who joins me on the program today. I did not realize until I read your book that in this country, starlings are so reviled. Now, I had been aware that in Europe, they are not considered to be pests. In fact, aren't they endangered? I had heard that from, I think, Julie Zickafoos told me that.
Mm-hmm. It's true. You know, it's funny. People like most people just like who like nature like birds, and if they haven't delved into it as a, you know, a bird watcher or a birder, they don't really know the details of what we think about individual birds. Most people can't even with confidence, you know, 100% confidence identify a starling. But when you go a little deeper, you do find that they are a non-native invasive species here. They weren't introduced until 1890 here, and that was in Central Park. And there are only 20 birds. So the 200 million some birds that we see now that have spread all over the entire country came from that initial introduction of 20 birds in Central Park. So they're aggressive, they're clever, they're adaptive. They eat agricultural crops, both grains, and now they're spreading to wine country. And I learned that they actually cause $800 million in agricultural damage every year. So from that standpoint, it's bad enough. But from the conservationist standpoint, the problem is that they are cavity nesters. So they don't build nests in trees. They build nests in holes in trees or holes in buildings. And in natural areas, though, those natural cavities are very sought after nest sites for birds like chickadees and sensitive birds like bluebirds. And so starlings are hated for out-competing these wonderful native birds for these nest sites. Whereas, as you say, it's a surprise, on the other hand, for most people who are birders and do hate starlings, to find out that in Europe, where it's the same species, the European starling. There are actually several species of starlings nationwide, but the one we're talking about in this story, Mozart starling and the starling in this country, is a European starling. And in Europe, their numbers are declining because of the loss of that open agricultural space that they thrive on. And because they're a native species there, that decline is actual cause for concern. And so people are trying to protect starlings. I don't think they're officially endangered. I think they're what's called a species of concern, or what we would here call a threatened species. Their numbers are declining and people love them and are worried about them. Mm-hmm. So that contrast is really interesting as well.
Lyanda Lynn Haupt joins me on the program. We're talking about starlings, and we're going to talk a little bit about Mozart's starling. But first, I'd like to mention that I love starlings. I think they're beautiful,
uh-huh.
And I can never stop listening to them when I hear them outside singing and doing what they do. They are the most clever singers and improvisers. I'm just intrigued and fascinated by them, and I am so jealous of you. Because you have your own starling. Tell our listeners about Carmen, how you got her, and she's there right now with you, isn't she?
she's there right now, and she's in, well, yeah, she's a little quiet these days because it's spring. It's a time she would normally be on a nest, and the females are silent at that time. But the rest of the year, like the, they're different from other songbirds. Like you said, in most songbirds, the male sings the spring, you know, breeding territory song. The females and males through the rest of the year just have simpler vocalizations that they use. But with starlings, it's different. Starlings have incredibly complicated, wild, ranging songs. And both the males and the females sing them year-round. And so, yes, I live with a bird that is singing and vocalizing and participating in the aural dimension of our household constantly. And I do want to say up front that it is absolutely illegal to disturb the nest eggs or nestlings of any bird in North America. Birds are entirely protected. There are a couple of exceptions to that rule, and one of them is the starlings, because they're a non-native invasive species. Wildlife people actually encourage us to remove their nests if we see them, you know, nesting in our homes or buildings. They actually encourage us to remove them. And people can murder adult starlings however they want to without a license. But what you cannot do legally in most states, including mine, is keep one as a pet. So, totally outing myself to the starling police here on your show. I don't really know if there are starling police. So far, they haven't come knocking. But
you wrote a book about it. They know where you are.
They know where I am now. I know there's no hiding. So anyway, I was really deep into the research of the relationship between Mozart and his starling. So I read all the scientific papers I could on starlings. I put binoculars around my neck and walked all over the neighborhood to watch the wild starlings. I went to Vienna to see, you know, Mozart's apartment where he lived with the starling and tried to imagine it. And it just finally, I had to realize that the missing piece was actually living with a starling to really understand what that would be like. And so I learned that at a neighborhood park here in Seattle, there were a couple of starling nests that were going to be removed. And I also knew from my research on the starlings in the neighborhood that the eggs had already hatched. And I could tell, even though the nests were way, way back under the eaves of the bathroom of this park, that I could hear that wild churring sound that baby starlings make. So I knew they were in there. But the park officials didn't care. They're just getting rid of the starlings. So I had an informant from the park who told me, you know, when this was going to happen. And I just told the adventure of getting to this very inaccessible nest in this park without trying to attract too much notice. But we emerged with one very sickly, wheezing, sneezy little starling that had parasites crawling all over it. I tried to get another one just so that they would sort of keep each other warm, and this one looked like it was going to die at any second, but we couldn't reach another one. So that was the starling. She grew to flourish, and we named her Carmen, which means song. And she's a big part of our family now.
I love that story. And it's very cloak and dagger when you read in the book about all the details about how Carmen was brought into the family and how you raised her and what you've learned about her. And I can understand why starlings are invading wine country, because Carmen's a wino.
Oh, my gosh. She is. Wine is her favorite drink. And if we need to entice her to do something that she doesn't want to do, like maybe since she's not out in the wild, she's not getting her toenails, say, are growing longer than they would if she was out walking on natural ground all day. And her bill needs trimming, like a bird that was, you know, really digging through the grass and stones all day would not need its bill trimmed. So we have to do that for Starlet, for Carmen. And she's totally onto it. She's so smart. She knows when we want to, you know, she sees the implements of torture in the little clippers that I get out. And so she hides in her aviary. So I tempt her by getting out a wine glass. And some wine, and I pour it in the bottom, and she'll look at me, and she'll look at the clippers, and she'll kind of go, I know what you're doing, but she, in the end, cannot resist. if I start to pretend I'm drinking the wine, she's just on my shoulder in the wine glass. And it's not that way with anything else. She doesn't even sweet tasting liquors, like say rum or something like that. It's wine. She loves wine.
She prefers reds, right?
She prefers reds, but a nice bright California Chardonnay would be just fine.
And you also describe how you bathe her. And I just love this. This is so sweet.
It's super sweet. So a bath is an important part of Starling and, you know, daily health routine. So I had hoped that I would just put a bowl in a sink and she would take a bath in it. But Carmen is so friendly. She does not just want to be with us. She wants to be on us, on our head, on our shoulder, on our hand. And so with getting her to take a bath, I have to hold the bowl for her. And once I do, she's really excited. So I put a little trickle of water that she can sort of stand underneath, like a kind of like a raindrop, from the kitchen sink. And I hold her favorite Tupperware bowl underneath it. And she just gets in and splashes and splashes. And then she jumps out on my hand, gets in and just in and out. And I'm soaked. The whole kitchen practically is soaked because you would not believe how much one starling can splash. And then when she's done, she jumps on my shoulder and she shakes off and flies into her aviary. And then she doesn't want to come out for a couple hours because she's busy preening her freshly cleaned feathers.
This is the Book Nook on WYSO. I'll continue my conversation with Lyanda Lynn Haupt right after this. The book is Mozart's Starling. Lyanda Lynn Haupt wrote it, and she joins us on the program today. I guess we better talk a little bit about Mozart. There's actually some belief that kind of an unusual piece of his music might have been inspired by his starling. Let's talk about his starling, what we know about that bird.
Yeah, so what we do know is that in 1784, Mozart was living in Vienna, and he didn't keep good records of anything, but he did keep track of a couple things. He kept track of all of the work that he finished, and he kept track for a time in a little notebook of all of the purchases that he made. So we have this little trail from 1784. We know that in mid-April of that year, so if you think about it, this is the high classical period for arts and music in Vienna, kind of center of all of that. He wrote down that he had just finished his concerto in G major. It's beautiful, number 17, beautiful, sweet concerto. And that concerto was slated for public performance in June. And as far as historians have known for, you know, most of the time that Mozart is being studied, that was the first time that it was eventually performed. Mm-hmm. In between that time, the time that it was written, completed, and the time that it was performed in June, Mozart made another little notation in his purchases notebook. He noted that he spent a few kreutzer to buy a starling bird. And not only that, he wrote down that it sang a line of the motif from this concerto in G that he had completed a month before. And he wrote it down two ways in his notebook. He wrote it the way that he wrote it, and he wrote it the way the starling sang it, which was with a little bit of a twist. It added sort of this long pause called a fermata, and it sharped two of the G's in the motif. And because Mozart is famously paranoid about other composers stealing or imitating his work, biographers, when they mention this, say it's not actually, there's not much mentioned about Mozart's starling at all in the official biographies. But when it is mentioned, they say that Mozart, you know, must have been furious that somehow his work had gotten out there. But actually, under his copied out version of the starling song, he wrote, and forgive, I don't speak German, but he wrote Das war schön, which I'm told translates best as that was wonderful.
Wow. That's an amazing story.
We bought the bird and took it home. I know. It's amazing. It's a wonderful story. And true. We have this ephemera that, or evidence of this ephemera that documents this story. And then later, when the starling died, 3 years later, he wrote a beautiful poem, an original elegy for the starling.
And it is beautiful. And he didn't go to his father's funeral, who died 2 months before the starling, but then he had an elaborate ceremony for the starling. And of course, people read other things into this. He really couldn't afford to go to his father's funeral, but he had a nice service for the starling.
He did. Yeah, his relationship with his father was very fraught. Leopold was kind of authoritarian and had a lot of opinions about how Mozart should manage his career. But there was a great, great deal of love and respect there as well. So Leopold died in Salzburg, which is 250 miles of bad carriage road from Vienna, where Mozart had a wife with a septic leg and two kids and all kinds of composing to do, and they were broke. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I disagree with most of the biographers who say that he, you know, rebelled against his father's memorial. I just think he just couldn't go.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, 2 months later, and it must have been very, you know, this sorrowful time in his life, 2 months later, his starling died. And I know from living with a starling what a cheering presence they can be. And so I've heard some biographers say that this funeral that he had for a starling was just a joke or a farce. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Mozart had a great absurd sense of humor. And so a starling formal funeral might have appealed to that. Some have said it was sort of a form of transference, you know, since he couldn't do his proper memorial for his father, he had one for his bird.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that makes sense to me too. I mean, maybe there really was something to the ritual of a funeral that gave him some solace. But living with a starling, I know beyond a doubt that one dimension of the funeral was completely serious, that he was really, really sad that his starling died. Mm-hmm. And in this little elegy that you see that he wrote, you can see that he totally understood the playful, mischievous nature of the starling. And not just understood it, but it reflected part of his own personality. Mm-hmm. I think it was a perfect pet for Mozart.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. And my guest in the Book Nook today is Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Her book is Mozart's Starling. I love the way you pivot back and forth from what you know and what you imagine about Mozart's Starling and your own adventures with Carmen. And I'm sure some of our listeners out there are wondering, what about the bird poop?
It's an important question. It's one I hear. So Carmen has a big aviary in the corner, one corner of our house. And because she's there a lot of the time, the poop just gathers on the newspapers underneath her. But most of the time, you know, when it's safe, we have the door open so she can fly back and forth as she pleases. And what I said before is actually important here, that she doesn't just want to be, she wants to be with us and super close to us all the time when she's out of her aviary. So it's not like she's flying randomly around the house, just pooping anywhere. She's mostly just pooping on me. So she'll sit on my head. I get bird poop in my hair. I put on a shirt that, you know, over the clothes I'm wearing for the day when she's out. So she poops on my shoulder. It goes on that shirt.
Mm.
When friends come over, if, you know, some people, it's interesting, some people are really afraid of birds. It's kind of an irrational fear. So I always ask before letting Carmen out when there are guests here. But if they're happy to have her out, then I offer, one of the services we offer here at our house is a poop shirt for guests. If they want to put something over their own clothes, they can do that. Because Carmen does like to land on the shoulder and visit with new people.
Uh-huh. Well, as I was reading Mozart's Starling, I was reminded of my life-changing experience that I had with a bird. And I've only had the one, but I, if you don't mind, I'd like to share it with you. I was working in a record store many, many years ago, and it was kind of an early spring day. It was just warm enough to have the door open, and the door was open. And I was standing behind the counter with one of my coworkers, and suddenly there was this flapping of wings. and this beautiful dove comes flying into the door of the store and lands on my shoulder. Landed right on my shoulder. And
oh, my goodness.
And I was like, what? And so we thought, well, we need to give this bird some food. And so my friend went out to his car. He had something with seeds in it, which he brought back in. And, and he gave some of the seeds to the bird. And then the bird went over on a ficus tree in the corner and just went to sleep. And so I took the bird home.
From the store?
It was a ring-necked turtle dove.
Uh-huh.
It must have belonged to somebody.
And it must have been an escaped pet, yeah.
I think so. But I had that bird for a number of years, and at the time I had a cat, and I lived in an apartment, and they loved each other. I would let the bird fly around in the apartment and go into its cage at will and come out and fly and land on my shoulder, and I could hold my finger up, and it would come and land on my finger, and it was just a beautiful bird. And one time I came home, and the bird was standing on the cat's back. The cat. I'm serious. I couldn't believe it. The cat.
Believe you.
Yeah, the cat. It was the most life changing experience for me to know this bird. I've never had another bird in my life, and this one just came to me.
And did it make you think about? I know you're interviewing me, but what I find is that when people have these relationships with an individual animal, especially one that is not normally considered a pet, it changes the way you walk in the world. Because, I mean, this has been the case with me and Carmen. She is so, I mean, this is something we haven't talked about, but I'm sure your dove had her own way of sort of interacting with what was going on in your apartment. But mm-hmm. one of Carmen's ways of interacting with us is through her vocalizing. So you talked about how not it's a surprise to people that starlings are reviled, but it's also a surprise to almost everybody that starlings are really good mimics.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the it's a mystery how Mozart's starling learned its song, but it's not a mystery that it could sing it, because starlings are as good of mimics as parrots. And so they can imitate human voices, human music, other animals, environmental sounds. So Carmen mimics, you know, the sound of our microwave, pitch perfect, can't tell them apart from the next room, the meow of the cat, the coffee grinder, things that we say to her like, hi, Carmen, and come here. And what took us way too long to understand was that she doesn't do this just randomly. She does do it randomly sometimes, and she also just mixes her mimic sounds within her crazy wild starling singing mm-hmm. sometimes. But the most significant and little known in the scientific literature aspect of it is that she anticipates vocally what's about to happen in our lives. So like when I come down the stairs in the morning, she says, hi, Carmen. Or when I walk past her aviary, if she's stuck in there, she says, hi, Carmen. When the cat walks by, she says, meow. And when I open the door of the microwave, that's when she says, beep, beep, beep. And when I open the jar for the coffee beans, that's when she imitates the coffee grinder. So she's sitting there consciously aware and anticipating what is coming next. And so it's amazing enough that this individual bird is doing this. But now when I walk into the world, I think, oh my gosh, all of the starlings are living in this just great wild awareness and consciousness. And not just the starlings, but every creature in its own way. And so it's made me just walk out with this great sense of the immense and secret and unknown and wonderful consciousness and intelligence of the world that we live in.
I love that.
Maybe you got some of that with your dove, too.
I can still hear that dove's call in my mind, and it's been many, many years, many, many years ago that this happened. My guest is Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Her book is Mozart's Starling. There is so much in this book, and I do need to mention there are some really great photos in here, but my favorite one is the author photo where Carmen is standing on top of your head. That's a nice touch.
Well, thank you.
Well, there's so many things to learn in this book, and it's just a fun read, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's not like any book I've read. I think you've found your own niche here with this one, Lyanda.
Thank you.
Are you working on another book?
I'm working on another book. It's a departure for me. It's still top secret, but I hope that we'll talk about it one day.
Well, I hope so, too. Well, it's really been a pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Lyanda Lynn Haupt in the Book Nook talking about Mozart's Starling. And I heard from a listener the other day who was tuning in for the Book Nook on Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, and we were off the air because of a lightning storm. And she said, well, I did the next best thing. I went to the WYSO website, and I listened to an archived interview on the Book Nook from our podcast array at WYSO.org. Just go to the Book Nook page, and you could listen to a different interview every single day of the year. We have that many of them archived on there. That's at WYSO.org. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. It's always a pleasure to be with you on Saturdays at 7 a.m. and on Sundays at 10:30.